Great to see you all this morning. This is going to be a little different than your sort of normal sermon on a Sunday for two reasons. One, I didn't grow up in an Episcopal church. I actually grew up in a Pentecostal church. And a Pentecostal church, if you know anything about sort of black church tradition, when their sermons go on, there's a lot of kind of calling, what we call call and response, a lot of sociality happening, right? Because what sort of is understood, much like in jazz or in music, the audience helps make the sermon. Right? Like, too often we think of the preacher as the one sort of depositing the word in us, right? When in actuality, it's an exchange. So we have to have a little exchange this morning, right? We're going on. I like that. There we go. We ready. Right on. We ready. Let's go. Right? And the other thing is, I'm a poet, right? And so the way that I come to thinking about maybe the sacredness of a space like this, of God, right, of something divine, of something large like the universe, is through the poem. So we're going to do a little reading of a poem together, right? So so this is going to be a little different, right? It's going to be a little close reading. So if you've ever taken like an English literature class, maybe this will seem familiar, but I guarantee you it won't be as boring. I'll try to also keep it as short as possible. Like I said, in Pentecostal church, y'all, I don't even know if you've ever been to a black church. You can be there from 10 to 1 or 2. We're not going to do that today. We're going to practice some other things today. And so I'm so happy to be here. I have to thank St. John's Episcopal Church for having me out, Pastor Mary for guiding me through this week, Pastor Jimmy and Pastor Travis for extending this invitation. I love Wyoming. I came here last year for the first time out to the space, and I was running about the Gros Ventre and finding like deer that had been like eaten by something, and there was still like the leg of it. It was awesome, right? So I wanted to come back, right, and sort of bring this. And when they asked me to come back, I was humbled by this opportunity to be a lay pastor, partly because I also, like I said, I grew up in the Pentecostal church, and what you wouldn't know is that when I was younger, people thought that I was going to become a minister because I was running around actually at the ages of like 5, 6, and 7. After hearing a sermon, I would come home and run around my mom's house yelling, "I'm a preacher of the gospel." Or sometimes I'd be like, "I'm a preacher like John the Baptist." So it's interesting that John the Baptist came up today. I still have my head. But I think of poetry as a type of calling, right? And so what we're going to do, right, to practice a calling to each other, I would like you to turn to your neighbor and say, "Neighbor, good morning." And then ask your neighbor how they're doing. All right. This is going to be important. This is going to be important because throughout the sermon, there might be times where I have to ask you to interact with your neighbor. All right. So now that you know your neighbor, we ready?
Yeah.
All right. So one of the things I love about sort of this opportunity is it's the opportunity to bring good news, right? So much of the news we get is not good news in the world. So this is an opportunity to bring good news. And tonight or today, the good news is of a lovely love. Now turn to your neighbor and say, "Neighbor, let's get ready to receive some good news." So, A Lovely Love, it's a poem by Gwendolyn Brooks. Gwendolyn Brooks was the first black poet to receive the Pulitzer Prize. She was born in 1917 in Topeka, Kansas. Became really known as Chicago poet, and I consider her one of the greatest poets ever. And this is a poem I've been sort of deliberating with and sitting with for many, many, many years. And I just love this poem, so I wanted to bring this good news to you. It's called A Lovely Love. Let it be alleys, let it be a hall, whose janitor javelins epithet and thought, to cheapen hyacinth darkness that we sought, and played we found rot make the petals fall. Let it be stairways and be a splintery box, where you've thrown me and scraped me with your kiss, have honed me, have released me after this cavern kindness, smiled away our shocks. That is the birthright of our lovely love in swaddling clothes, not like that other one, not lit by any foundling star above, not found by any wise men either. Run. People are coming. They must not catch us here, definitionless in this strict atmosphere. Let it be alleys, let it be at hall, the poem starts. Too often we think of love, particularly a lovely love, we think it must occur in comfort, secured and nurtured in rooms, in the bedrooms and houses of hotels, in classrooms and schools of universities, in the sanctuary of a church. Alleys, hallways, we consider moments of transit, liminal, banal, reeking of the everyday, something between here and there, and not a place to establish or nurture anything like love. Alleys in particular are dirty. If you live in a city like Chicago, like Gwendolyn Brooks did, or even in Austin like I do, restaurants, apartment building dwellers throw their trash away in alleys. Often they smell putrid. If you've ever been in an alley, you know what I'm talking about. It is the place where we hide what's been discarded until someone else will come to haul away what we consider refuse. However, Brooks commends us and even prods us to partake of our love, to allow our love to blossom in these zones of nowhere, in these forgotten spaces. Sometimes we won't have the option to explore or nurture our love in the prescribed or recommended rooms. Instead, we must lay ourselves down in love where it finds us. I've been thinking about this sort of reconnaissance and occupation of these zones of nowhere this week, but it's been in terms of writing. For me, I prefer to write in an office with a desk and a chair, books all over the place, the door closed, and the house absolutely quiet in the morning. I know, lots of requirements. But since being in Jackson, I've written in a basement, in the adult section of the library, at the public library, in the children's section of the public library, in bed, on bed, outside while waiting for a 4th of July parade to start, walking behind the rear end of a police horse. I've ridden with my daughter sitting across from me and asking every 2 or 3 minutes how to spell off and head. This week she was writing, she was conceiving of images about the Queen of Hearts, and so therefore off with her head was a phrase we were dealing with quite a bit. It's so interesting that John the Baptist was this week's gospel. I'm like, off with, I was like, Naima already knew. I've had to catch as catch can, which is to say, I've had to let it be alleys. I've had to let it be a hall. Sometimes in order to practice our love, our craft, we must relinquish what we believe to be the ideal circumstance. Sometimes being in a practice, religious, artistic, a practice of familial, romantic, or platonic love, requires us to reject our notion of that practice. I'm going to say this again. This is going to sound like I'm offering a Buddhist coin a wisdom text. But sometimes being in practice requires us to reject our notion of that practice. One of my favorite poets, Aimé Césaire, a Martinican writer who grew up under the shadow and heavy hand of French colonialism, once said in an interview that in order to write poetry, he had to renounce poetry. What he meant and means is that in order to write the poem he needed to write, he had to reject what was considered traditional French poetry, even reject the avant-garde poetry aesthetic of his day. For instance, the surrealist at the time, this is at the height of surrealism, they were like, oh, he's one of us. And he was like, no, this is, I'm making this in Martinique. Right? He had to reject sort of these aesthetics in order to write the poem that only he could write, he being a Martinican, a colonial subject, black, and trying to articulate a sense of sound in the world that did not kowtow to any French colonial idea of his life, capacity, or sense of love. Like Césaire, we too must step out into the hallways where there might be a janitor, which we understand as a hater in the parlance of today, who derides us for being there, for thinking in that space, for nurturing our love in a place that is supposedly loveless, funky, weird, wrong, out of bounds. With his mop, which Brooke calls his javelin, he castigates us with epithets, tries to cheapen the hyacinth darkness we sought. But the hyacinth darkness, what the janitor and our haters would drive us from, is the place of beauty, of blossoming, of becoming. Normally we think of light, of being in light, as requisite for knowledge. In fact, light has become synonymous with knowledge. Light has become synonymous with clarity, even love. However, for Brooks, darkness bears and brings its own fecundity. In fact, flowers grow at night and need that darkness. The love we might need to nurture might not be able to be done in the light, but in the dark. In other words, our lovely love might be born of darkness, but not a reprobate darkness. Not a darkness that must be driven out by light, but a darkness that makes our lovely love known to us. Now turn to your neighbor. Say, neighbor. Don't be scared of the dark. However, this lovely love is not without its tensions, its conflicts, its rot. Brooks offers us a bluesy lovely love, offers us that even as we play about in our love, it's not without its potential scrapes and cuts and wilting petals. And isn't it true of the practice of love, of art, of a craft, that we are sometimes growing toward difficulty? Isn't it true that the petals falling from a flower is also growth? It's an ironic sense of growth for sure, but I can't help but think of my partner who's here, Monica, the blue sage she plants every year in a circular bed in our front lawn. Around late September or so, the sage loses its, what I call its blue diadem, those blue beautiful petals, and goes to seed. Our lovely love requires going to seed sometimes, allowing it to go dormant. Now look to your neighbor and say, neighbor.
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 It's all right. Sometimes we must go to seed. Now the next part of the poem, let it be stairways in a splintery box where you have thrown me and scraped me with a kiss, have honed me, have released me after this cavern kindness, smiled away our shocks. Despite the petals falling, Brooks corroborates that our lovely love must go on, will persist despite dormancy. However, we might need to transport or relocate our lovely love. We might need to keep letting it, allowing it, even if we have to take it to a smaller space and place. In the poem, we move from halls and alleys to stairways in a splintery box. And this splintery box is going to be really important. We're going to see this is going to come back later in the poem. In fact, the space has become more cramped and precarious. While cramped, a stairway might suffice to nurture a love of practice. There might be a place to sit, stand, write, to draw, to contemplate. But when we move to a splintery box, we are in a completely different realm of discomfort and possibly disorientation and pain. If we are in a splintery box, the likelihood with us coming out of that place with splinters is a certainty. However, we must go there. Brooks signals this difficult continuation of a lovely love, and that not only will it have to take place in a stairway or a splintery box, but that the lover, the practice, has thrown the speaker there. Even as the speaker of the poem is thrown into the box by the beloved, they've also been scraped by a kiss. While this line might connote a gesture towards violence, to read it as such purely might be to actually miss the difficulty of nurturing an unsanctioned or hyacinth dark blossom love. As we've already established, sometimes we love what we love, what we practice will put us in difficult and uncomfortable circumstances. Not because the love is difficult or malignant in some form, but because of how others perceive or receive our love, our practice. Can I tell y'all a quick story? So, I'm a poet, right? Now, you have to imagine, you have to go back now 24 years ago, and I'm coming out of a working class family. Mom, grandmother were domestics, and I'm going to Princeton University. I'm going there to be aerospace engineer. I've tested into a flight position for the Air Force. I'm pre-med, right? I want to be an astronaut. I want to fly. I want to become a flight surgeon so that I can eventually. I'm working on plasma rockets. And I tell my mother after my freshman year, I'm absolutely sad and depressed. I think I want to be a poet. My mother looked at me and said, "You are giving up on life." I also was moving away from the religious tradition that I'd been raised in. And my mother couldn't see what I saw. And she stopped speaking to me for a few years. It became a really difficult moment. You have to, you know, if you're in your early 20s and you're trying to make it, you know, and you decide, hey, I'm going to strike out in this path that no one else can see, you at least want your parents to be there. And I remember my 20s being a very lonely time. But there was something that I really appreciate my mother doing when I turned 35. So this is 15 years after I decided to, you know, become a poet, and I published a book, and that book did all right. It won a few awards, and it was some of them were national awards, and they were in like newspapers like the Washington Post. And my mother came to me and she said to me, and I think this is really important, because I think this speaks to her character as well. She said, "You know, I couldn't see what you saw 15 years ago. I didn't see it. But I'm glad you kept going." Sometimes, she said, parents don't see what our children can see. And we have to let them sort of go down that path. And so I'm so glad she sort of said that to me right as I was having my daughter. Right? Because I think that is like maybe the largest lesson she's ever given me. The back. The love or practice should persist because what it nurtures, what it calls forth in us and others. Look to your neighbor, say, "Neighbor,
neighbor.
Hold on.
Hold on."
And so sometimes we'll feel as if our love or practice has thrown us into a splintery box, has forced us there. But sometimes the splintery box, that staircase, will allow us to see, feel, touch, kiss what we would not have been able to kiss, see, touch, feel without it. I am not calling for deprivation's sake. However, sometimes we must go find our love, our practice in spaces where we would not have gone, where the resources that we needed wouldn't have been seen because it required us to be without the trappings and comforts we have been used to. For me, I think about my time in graduate school in College Station and Bryan, two small cities in the state of Texas that are home of Texas A&M University. To call them cities is a stretch. It's like squinting at a pit bull and calling it a pig. While they both might grunt and wheeze in heat, a pit bull is not a pig and a pig is not a pit bull. So you're probably catching on that there was very little in these twin cities other than two or three grocery stores, a barber shop or two, Barnes & Noble, a gaggle of churches, a sprawling university, and a strip of bars across from the university, several of which black students were told not to go into if we loved ourselves or our lives. Anybody that knows College Station will know about this, the Dixie Chicken. Despite that little bit of action, I still found plenty of trouble to get into, but not enough. When I told my friends and classmates that I had come from Atlanta to College Station, a veritable cultural desert, they shook their heads. None scoffed, but I did feel a little like Job on the telephone with my friends and mentors. It felt as if their pregnant silences and pauses, they were going down in sackcloth and ashes with me. I could feel them shaking their bowed heads on the phone, wondering silently, what has Brother Reeves done? What has he gotten himself into? And to gussy up the pig a little bit, I actually lived in a splintery box. I lived in a very wooden apartment above an old barn, and the whole structure shook when the wind blew. The structure was so old that when the utility man came to turn on the heat, he refused because the infrastructure was so old. He was sure that it would burn the house down. So in winter, in order to warm the house on those cold, gray days in Texas, I had to turn my oven on, open up the door to heat that 200 square feet space. I felt scraped, splintered, thrown away, and thrown down while living so precariously in Bryan and College Station. However, I was there to become a poet, and it's what I could afford. Actually, I couldn't afford it. I constantly juggled not paying one bill in order to pay another. Some of us have been there. However, without those 40 days and 40 nights in my wilderness, in my cave, in my trouble, I would not come by certain images or certain preoccupations. For instance, in a poem called Cross Country that I've written, I have an image of two dead wild hogs laid tusk to tail in a ditch. I experienced that image while running a farm-to-market road somewhere inside or outside College Station on an early Saturday morning, 6 years before it actually appeared in a poem. It was not just the experience that provided images for my poems, but College Station itself began to be the imagination that I cultivated there. My love for nature, for its teachings, my wonder for more than the natural world began in rural Texas, and it has driven me here to the Tetons. I know that I would not be the writer, father, poet, teacher, runner, lover, partner without those cold days in that barn and the wind getting in between the ribs of my splintery box and causing it to rock. But neighbor, while it might feel as if I'm quite far from the poem, I am not. Sometimes we must go to our splintery boxes, go into our stairways, into our alleys and halls, and let our love. Sometimes we must allow ourselves to be thrown down in it, scraped with its blessings, its kisses, allow it to hone us, to sharpen us, refine us. And only after we've been refined, have been sharpened, will it release us. Say, neighbor,
neighbor.
Your release is coming.
Release.
It literally is, y'all. We about to end this. Brooks notes that after the shock of being thrown, kissed, and honed, then we must be released. What Brooks points us towards is that our love, our practice, requires enduring the difficulty of its making. Our love, our practice, requires enduring the difficulty of its making. In other words, becoming the lovers, artists, parents, clergy, poets, designers, teachers, ranchers, is a process. One whose process is made through the activity, therefore known and unknown. In other words, we must walk in whatever light or darkness that is in front of us. In other words, what might have been a lit path before us might suddenly turn dark, but that doesn't mean stop walking. Now turn to your neighbor and say, neighbor, walk. And while it might seem this message is for you, it is for me also, neighbor. Roger, you must walk. Walk on even in doubt when the path seems full of brambles and ticks and the buzzing things all around you are clattering. And the mountain is tall, it's hard to climb, and the switchback's unrelenting. Neighbor, we must walk because this love, this difficulty is actually a cavern kindness, a deep kindness. It is the kindness of love. What we have been practicing and allowing ourselves to step into this difficult practice is a love for ourselves and the transforming for others. The difficulty brings us closer to ourselves, to others. This notion of a transformational love is why I believe Brooks turns to the birth of Jesus next in the poem. Look at these lines. That is the birthright of our lovely love in swaddling clothes, not like the other one, not lit by any foundling star above, not found by any wise men either. While it might seem that Brooks is dismissive of the birth of Jesus, aggrandizing her notion of a lovely love over that of the birth of the Messiah, I assure she is not. She's ironically bringing them into conversation. In fact, throughout the whole poem, she has used the situation of the birth of Christ as a sort of model or form for her poem. Let's go over the circumstances of the birth of Jesus. He's born in a strange land. There's no room for him or his parents. So he's born in a manger, in a barn, in a splintery box. Right? The manger is the splintery box. In fact, his first bed is a splintery box. What does the birth of Christ signify? A new sense of life, of redemption, of love. In other words, a lovely love. Go to the second line of the poem. There's another sort of Christological symbol or reference, right? Whose janitor javelins epithet and thought. The javelins call back to the javelins and spears that pierced the adult Jesus in the side. And when he was being marched to the hill, that he was killed upon? And didn't folks yell expletives, epithets at him, mocking him for saying that he was Christ, mocking him for his sense of love he was trying to bring into the world? Brooks, throughout the poem, has lifted the circumstances in the form of the life of Christ and extended it through a type of bluesy revision, one that exemplifies both the sacred and secular ways a spiritual love has everyday applications. And in this way, offers us, the reader, a way of being, a way of feeling that allows us to love, to practice love more abundantly. Brooks does turn from the life of Christ in what might be her most audacious move in the poem, and I actually had to reconsider this. I wrote this, and then I was like, actually, Christ does run at some point, but it's not Christ who runs, it's his parents, right, when he's a child, but you'll see what I'm saying. Brooks turns from the life of Christ in what might be her most audacious move in the poem. She commands us to run. Whereas before she asked us to let things occur, now she tells us to run because people are coming. This move is not what Christ, or at least the one I encountered in the Pentecostal church I grew up in, did. Christ continues towards his crucifixion because that was the continuation of his lovely love. The love that he authored was required to practice, required his removal of sorts. And there's a whole sermon there that in order for love, for the love we want to see in the world, we must sometimes remove ourselves from its presence so that it might go on. But Brooks offers us another way of extending our love, which is through living. Living beyond the naysayers, the doubters, those who might want to destroy us because we are definitionless in this strict atmosphere. And isn't that the purpose of love? To render us definitionless, which is to say, all, willing to bear and love all. Now turn to your neighbor and say, neighbor, let us go out and make a lovely love. Say, neighbor.
Neighbor.
What?
What?
Who will you love today?
Who will you love today?
That you have not loved yet.
That you have not loved yet.
Now let's go out there and bring the good news of this into the world. Thank y'all.